Have you ever had surgery?
Then you can be a surgeon.
Sound absurd?
That's what happens in education.
Become a teacher, a superintendent.
You can even become the Secretary of Education for the United States of America. No experience needed. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education.
From the MiamiHerald.com, this teacher's favorite textbooks were taken from her classroom. Her principal did it. Audrey Silverman arrived at Dr. Michael M. Kropp Senior High School last week, ready to finish The Necklace, an English class staple short story about the deceptiveness of appearances and the dangers of martyrdom with her gifted honors ninth grade students. But when the literature teacher entered her classroom on Thursday morning, 50 textbooks, including the teacher's edition with years of annotations Silverman said she personally purchased, were missing from the baskets underneath the students' desks. A student told Silverman she saw the books carted away the prior evening.
Whoa.
Somebody came in and took all the books?
Someone took all of her books. And actually, it's not a someone, because the title of the story tells us the principal did it. Well, as we were talking from the previous story, this must be an administrator that came from Maryland.
Hasn't gone through that steal thing yet.
No credentials. The principal stole the textbooks, and they're reading The Necklace. And so the first thought is that there must be something. When books are gone in these types of situations, it's usually a parent complains and finds
True.
Something in the book that's offensive.
Yes.
Right?
Yeah.
And so then everybody gets on the high alert. Oh, my God.
Can't read this stuff. My kid can't see.
Yeah, my kid saw the word D-A-M-N.
Right.
Okay, and all is lost.
Right.
And so get that out of there. That's not what happened here. The big issue is that her school district in Florida, the state of Florida, adopted a new literature series that is on, quote, as they call it, tablet devices. Mm-hmm. And it's called Collections.
Okay.
And it costs a quadrillion million dollars.
Yeah, it does.
Okay. And the reality is that this teacher, Miss Silverman, was like, yo, I don't want to teach literature from tablets from a collection called Collections, because the crap in Collections is crap and it's digital and it doesn't work. And I'm a teacher and I should know what works. I've been doing this for 30 years.
She's an amazing teacher, too. Says she's been one of the best teachers in the state.
Even from a test score perspective.
Right.
She's got all the test scores.
She's passed all of her tests.
But, you know, inside here, this is one of the biggest issues why they say they got rid of her books, is because the tablet and the new reading curriculum on the tablet is much more aligned with the state test.
Yes.
Right? Now, got to give props, though, because there's another person that appears, Seresta Smith, 30-year veteran, and co-opt-out founder with none other than me and a bunch of other people. Seresta's awesome, though. And Seresta's like, yo, look, I'm 30 years into this to myself. Nobody's going to tell me what to use. This digital crap ain't cutting it. I'm not doing it. Seresta, Miss Silverman, you are busting pencils.
From Diane Ravitch's blog, New York, Common Core produces massive failure in writing. Remember all the bold promises about Common Core? Remember the claims that it would increase achievement for all students and close the achievement gap? That's what David Coleman, architect of the Common Core and now president of the College Board, maker of the SAT, claimed, along with a plethora of Gates-funded advocates for Common Core.
Hey, if David Coleman and you're backed up by Gates create something called the Common Core, it has to work. But, oh, my God, in New York, no.
Oh, no,
right?
It didn't work.
You get into Diane Ravitch's blog here, which is actually a summation of a pretty significant research study that went on for the past 4 years, tracking scores of students, and particularly in writing, since the adoption of the Common Core curriculum.
Mm-hmm.
Okay? And this is one of those things that's like, they didn't just do poorly. Out of a possible four points, they got zeros.
And a zero means totally inaccurate, unintelligible, or indecipherable. Kids were completely stupefied by these questions, is what people are saying. a zero for years. It's right. Not just one test.
Right. And so the quick, though, is to come and go, well, it's the kids and the teachers.
Right.
Typically, it's usually, well, the teachers didn't teach the standards the right way because the standards are foolproof. If you just do them, Bonnie, you don't need a superintendent's license or a teaching license or anything. You don't need anything because the standards are so awesome by themselves. Mm-hmm. It just requires that you do them.
It just works.
And then it just works. And no, these were actually teachers following the standards, following the curriculum, doing what they're supposed to do. And every time this group of students was tested over the span of 4 years, they came back not zeros. The zeros doubled.
Right. So it just gave me more zeros and more zeros.
Typically, you say, you know, a new curriculum, you'll say sometimes, hey, there is a drop in scores. That happens because it's new, right? Mm-hmm. But as people recover, then that changes and you start to see gains and or flatlines. But on this one, as it continues and as the students get more and more involved using it, they get worse. Right. So this is frightening because actually the common core that so many people, whether you're Donald Trump, whether you're Scott Walker, wherever you are, people believe it's not being implemented. But the Common Core has just taken on different names all across the country. Mm-hmm. It is in the elementary schools of most of the country. It is the language arts curriculum. And so here we're getting a glimpse in New York. And I don't care if you call it the Alabama Core, the Wisconsin Awesome Core.
It doesn't matter.
Okay, it doesn't matter. You just renamed it to make the Tea Party people quit yelling at you. Mm-hmm. It's still the Common Core. What are the effects nationwide, then, of using this curriculum on writing across everybody? We already had an achievement gap to begin with, right?
Now it's doubled.
Oh, my God. Okay. Then add to that how much money has the state of New York invested in the Common Core? And here you have to look and go, is that really what's at issue? Because if with this amount of massive failure, that amount of money— somebody should pull the plug, but guess what? They're going to invest another couple of quadrillion dollars.
From the Baltimore Sun, Maryland State School Board agrees to allow non-educators to become superintendents. The state school board voted Tuesday to allow the appointment of non-educators to superintendent positions. The new regulation passed despite significant protests by educators across the state, including the association representing local school boards.
Wow. So if you have, I know you've always thought about being a superintendent, Bonnie. Now you know where you can go.
I can go to Maryland.
You can go to Maryland because you don't need superintendent education credentials.
My radio career will do it for me. Perfect.
Well, if you read in here, as long as you've been awesome at something.
Well, okay. Awesome's a good gauge.
Right. That's a good gauge. So as long as you were awesome at something. Now, up front, this is not in effect yet. So it's still out there. It's got to be listened to. There's a phase where people comment. The question is, will it be law at some point? Maybe, because there was an adaptation, if you read deeper into this, that says, okay, look, we're going to give the awesome person a chance, but they're only going to be interim for a year, and during that year, they have to take 6 graduate credits of administration and education courses.
It's on-the-job training.
On-the-job training.
Pretty much.
And so that is kind of like, well, people are like, well, maybe we can live with that, right? And no, because inside the article, there's this man, Chester Finn, who just appears as if he's just some Chester Finn guy. And just to dig deep, Chester Finn is a guy who hates educators. He's one of the founders of the Fordham Foundation that's backed up by millions of dollars from millions of dollars of people who don't like educators. And he even makes a comment that adding the 1 year interim in the 6 credits essentially watered down the bill so bad that it's worthless.
We don't want to train them. We just want somebody with no qualifications.
He wanted absolutely zero qualifications, except awesome.
Oh, awesome. Yep. Okay. That's the best thing.
Except awesome here. So this is this weird kind of movement in education to take away education credentials and just find, quote, you know, and usually this refers back to a businessman. Is there an awesome businessman in the area? Because if there is, they can run a school system too, because they've proven through the business world that they know how to run things.
So here's my question. Are there a shortage of people that want to be superintendents? Are they really looking that far outside the range?
there's no shortage. And the last time I checked, millionaire, multimillionaire company owners are not looking to drop into the $100,000 range of being a superintendent. So this is really, though, about taking actually credentials and watering them down, getting them to the point and taking newer people in there who don't have them. This is the war on education. And as I said, you know what? If it works for superintendents, though, please sign me up, because I want to be the head of the American Surgical Association, because I watched ER a lot. And as a kid, I watched MASH all the time.
All the time. And you're awesome.
And I'm awesome.
There you go.
So I should be allowed to be. No, I'm not going to be I'm just going to be in charge of surgeons.
We are Busting Pencils.
Well, he is my brother from another mother. Welcome back to the show, Michigan State University Associate Professor of Teacher Education, Mitchell Robinson. Mitchell, thank you for coming on the show again.
My pleasure. Good to be here.
I said I love this. You are out there more than anybody finding everything that is going on in education in the social media world and making sure that we all look at the silliness. In fact, you went out and found somebody who always strikes me as being silly and saying silly things, and that's being very nice by saying silly. Kate Walsh has now elevated herself and NCTQ to the, quote, refereed pseudo-journal of the Association of, what is it, from Educational Leadership. Now,
right.
That magazine is sponsored by what group?
Is it ASCD?
I think it's ASCD. Yeah. And so Ed Leadership is one of those, if you get published in there, do we call it research?
I think we call it, it's a professional journal.
Okay.
And I think it's well thought of, and sure.
Yeah, so typically there's good stuff in there. And so Kate Walsh now has taken the NCTQ approach, and if people don't remember that, that's the National Council for Teacher Quality, founded by the non-teacher Kate Walsh herself and lots of other millionaires who, of course, also have no real interest or any real expertise in teaching, but they are trying to tell Mitchell and I how to run our teacher education programs.
Well, that was their, I think, one of their first agenda items was to set themselves up as an evaluative body about teacher education programs
right.
across the country.
Because we stink.
So a number of years ago, they decided that they were going to do, and then got U.S. News and World Report to give them credit to go along with it, to do a ranking of all the, well, not all, but a good number, I think 500 or so,
right.
Teacher ed programs across the country. But, you know, there were some major problems. Maybe the most critical one was that their entire methodology was a review of syllabi
right.
that they culled and gathered from the World Wide Web.
Right. No systematic approach to taking these 500 schools and saying we need this criteria from every single one of you, so that when we're looking at the exact criteria across 500 schools, we can make reasonable claims based on evidence. Instead, we're going to find disparate evidence of 500 schools and then use some kind of, I would think, some kind of crazy Alfie Cone type of rubric that Alfie would rail on, and then rank these schools according to individual faculty members' syllabi.
Yeah, they used what I would, when I'm teaching about assessment in my classes, what I refer to as a beauty contest rating form. So kind of a 1-2-3 system,
right.
You know, 1 year good, 2 year your average, 3 year beyond reproach in the opposite direction. And so just, you know, kind of a really gross from a measurement standpoint kind of assessment of quality in teacher ed programs, but not based on a single visit to a campus, not based on any observations of classes or even conversations.
Right.
People that are teaching in the
yeah,
programs.
I actually wanted to point out, 5-6 years ago when I started as the dean at this at Edgewood College, where I am now, at NCTQ, and Kate herself, now I'm sure it wasn't Kate herself who signed the letter, but, you know, wrote a letter to my president at the time asking if you know, he would allow some type of participation in the NCTQ rankings. And at that time, right. my president, you know, before he said yes, and I was just there for a few months, and he said, "Hey, Tim, what do you think about this?" And I just looked at it and I said, "President, if we're going there, I'm not staying here." And yeah. He was with me. He was like, "Okay, then this is junk. We'll move on." And so I was like, "Yeah, this is great." So I will gladly say that Edgewood has no ranking with the National Council for Teacher Quality, and that's a no ranking we're proud of.
Well, and you share that dubious distinction with a number of schools that don't have teacher education programs but still received a ranking.
That's even better.
So you know, it's one of those things where, you know, and I've worked at three different universities now, and one of the particular conceits of universities is that out of one side of our mouth, we say we don't care about these independent rankings unless they're good.
Well,
and when they're good, we throw them up on our web pages and we tell our alums about them and we use them for fundraising. But when they're not good or we don't like the methodology, we say that these rankings don't matter. So I do wish that as institutions, we'd have a little more kind of institutional integrity and say, look, that's not what we do. We don't submit ourselves to A through F rankings by someone who never taught and doesn't know anything about teacher education. And in the same way now, I think Ms. Walsh has set her up as the arbiter of student teaching programs.
Right. This is wonderful, right? Because she's now, in fact, so we'll refer back to her latest piece. That's Kate Walsh. This is the chairman CEO of the National Council for Teacher Quality, pseudo-fake research organization that exists out there at the largesse of millionaires that would like to do away with public schooling. However, her article called Getting Smart About Student Teaching. And then if this was a real academic journal, it would have the two little dots. And better leveraging the student teaching process, school leaders can reduce costs and improve their talent pipeline. So now, Kate, is, you know, the whole process that you and I do in the 4 years of 5 years, however long it takes, getting our students ready for the penultimate experience to actually see if they're ready student teaching. She's now said, you know what, essentially, I'm not looking at that anymore, because the reality is that we could fix it all in student teaching.
Well, you know, somehow she decided that she would kind of maybe sit quietly in her office for 10 minutes and come up with a list of five reasons or five things that we could do better in teacher education in terms of student teaching. I don't know who asked her to do this. I don't know who wanted her to do this. I think it's also interesting, you know, most of her work has been targeted on collegiate teacher education programs, but virtually nothing in this article for Ed Leadership has to do with teacher education programs. It's all what school districts should do to get better student teachers.
Right.
And, you know, as someone who I've helped run the student teaching program here at Michigan State in music education for 15 years, I'm always looking for teachers to help us refine what we're doing or change what we're doing that's not working. And we have great cooperating teachers, and I value those relationships. But, you know,
so in other words, wait. So what you just said. So in other words, before she wrote this, she didn't call you.
Well, I'm not sure she called anyone. I think she does have five citations, because, you know, I think somebody probably in the office at Ed Leadership called her up after she sent this in and said, you know, we are a professional journal. It's an academic journal. You have to use citations. So she stuck. I guess there are six in here.
Right.
One is her own. It's
her own and, yeah, her own stuff, and then NCTQ stuff, which, again, I've pointed out many times to Stephen Sawchuk at Education Ed Week that, you know, please quit citing NCTQ work that isn't been peer refereed. And he said, well, research is research. But anyway, we'll move beyond that.
Yeah, I don't think anything on here is peer reviewed. Maybe there's one article that's peer reviewed, and that was just kind of thrown in passing in a meta kind of citation. But there's I guess the most offensive thing in here, and I was just talking to my wife last night, who's a practicing teacher in Michigan, was this idea that one of the things that school districts should do is work with the student teachers, those college students, those novices mm-hmm. that they've welcomed into their school district, and ask those student teachers to surreptitiously evaluate the mentor teachers that have agreed to work with them and rate them on whether they are sufficiently boostery enough about the school district and the administration.
Yeah, that
which
that
sounds to be like, you know, kind of a spy. It's kind of like the Americans, you know, we're bringing in student teachers and then asking them to spy on their cooperating teachers.
Well,
and
that,
I think that,
that,
you know, I wrote a little.
No, I think I just think about that part on the student teaching scoring rubric, you know, the last one, we're going to put that down, you know, it surveils cooperating teacher with excellence, with semi-excellence on an average basis. You know, we could rate that because, and then that would let us know. I know we're going to talk a lot about that, and I want to get a little bit deeper. Mitchell, let's take these tips one at a time and kind of go through them and, you know, put them under our scrutiny. You know, not that our scrutiny matters, but what the hell, let's do it. So number one, we doing student teach should carefully select mentor teachers. Okay?
Well, yeah, except actually her point is that the school district should actually carefully select mentor teachers.
Right, I need to rephrase that because as you said, right, this piece is not as much critical of us as she typically is, and it's more, and I wouldn't even say it's kind of like, hey, school districts. For me, it's like the criticism is, hey, school districts, if you want your teacher prep programs to get in line, here's what you do.
Well, there's also a premise behind this, and you know, her first point is that school districts should carefully select their mentor teachers. There's two kind of competing premises. One, that school districts are already not doing that, which I think is ridiculous.
Yeah.
And secondly, that the point of student teaching is to produce new teachers for those schools, which, of course, is not the point of student teaching any more than the point of education is job training purely. Education is a much more comprehensive process than just learning skills for a job. You can do that at, you know, the Roto-Rooter Trading Academy. What we're doing here is we're trying to help people find their voice as future teachers. And it's not really up to the school district or even the mentor teacher whether or not that student teacher takes a job in their school district. It's up to the student teacher.
Right.
So my student teachers right now, many of them are getting 2 and 3 job offers. One of our recent PhD grads had 6 interviews and 6 job offers. So the negative part of the teacher shortage is that it's harder to find teachers. The positive part of it is that teachers have some agency now in where they're going to teach, and they can maybe even negotiate some working conditions and salary conditions. And so this idea that school districts are going to carefully select mentor teachers, fine, but the goal is not so that they're going to then produce a new teacher for that school system.
But
that's not the goal of student teaching.
Right. And you know, I just throw this in. If you're not an NCTQ deep in the weeds critic, like some of us are, you also can look at this, and what she's saying is the mentor teachers that follow the prescription of the way we want people to teach in a certain way. So it's not quality mentor teachers. It's the mentor teachers that NCTQ and ed reformers like, which are, again, we could talk more about that, but we know what that's weighted,
It's compliant data-driven.
Right, compliant data-driven teachers. Okay, number two, hey, let's make sure we strategically select and place student teachers. So now mine and your students need to sit in front of, like, student teaching hiring boards.
Yeah, and, you know, again, some school systems already do this. Large urban school districts will often select, you know, they'll agree to place, you know, X number of math and X number of science teachers in their school district, and then there's some kind of a screening process about where those teachers should go. In my discipline in music, we're only ever placing, you know, 1, maybe 2 student teachers in the school district, so there's not that same kind of operation in place. But again, there's an assumption here that school districts parents are so dumb that they don't know how to do this.
Yeah.
And that truth is coming in to tell them that you should be strategic when you're putting student teachers in your schools. I think schools know that already. And Kate doesn't really give any guidelines for how to do that. She's just kind of yelling at them to do something that they're already doing.
Right.
Which, just, again, seems silly to me. There's also, though, an implication here that school districts should only accept candidates who meet the needs of their schools. And I don't know how, a school district personnel superintendent would know that with an incoming 22-year-old who has never taught before.
Well, that's why Busted Pencils exists. That's why you're out there making sure that people ask these questions that sometimes seem like, isn't somebody asking that? But no, sometimes they're not. And in fact, the ed reform movement is all about not asking questions and all about pushing, here's what we want, which would then be number three. Hey, school districts, look at student teaching. It's a 4-month interview process. Use that time wisely.
Yeah, and you know, and again, asking a student teacher to consider their student teaching placement as a job interview is like asking a plane mechanic to fix a plane that's already in the air. You know, what we have here are young people that are learning how to teach, and the last thing they really need is to consider all 4 months of that a job interview for that school. That's again really not what the student teaching placement is about. And, you know, I think Kate even understands that because she has a line in here about the level of scrutiny if we do this becomes too burdensome.
Too burdensome. But, well, you know, and here's the other thing, though, about this one. There's so much here that is like, you know, well, I mean, I think a lot of school districts, when they look at good student teachers, I've already had conversations with principals and stuff who would say, hey, we're really happy with such and such student teacher. You know, we've got this possibility. We're going to, you know, maybe present it. It's like, of course they look at their good student teachers as a potential candidate if they have a job. Now, whether our students want to take that job, that's up to them. But this idea that this doesn't go on, I mean, my God, 33 years ago, I remember student teaching,
right,
where I was student teaching, and I remember my, you know, the teachers in there going, boy, you'd be really good in this school, and it seems like everybody likes you. It's like, okay, cool, you know, and yeah, whatever, but really, we now need to put this in an academic journal. That, I think, is the other part. Hey, number four, though, let's move on to this. Treat mentor teachers as frontline recruiters.
Yeah, which is really saying treat mentor teachers as groomers. And that's, again, not what student teaching is. I had a brilliant doctoral student a few years ago who wrote her dissertation about the relationship between student teachers and cooperating teachers. And the recruiter never entered into our conversations about her research at all. The goal was to have some kind of a collaborative teamwork partnership kind of relationship. Because, again, what you're really helping someone do is learn how to become a teacher. And learning and teaching is about building relationships. Salesmanship is not a relationship.
And in this point, though, is buried where we were in the last segment, the idea then of counter-surveillance. The student teacher could then be reporting back on whether the, quote, mentor teacher, and let's be honest, what Kate's saying is, can the student teachers find the mentor teachers that might be out there doing non-compliant anti-education reform stuff?
Well, you know, here, I mean, the quote from the article is this: districts should always have student teachers evaluate their mentor teachers so that they can weed out teachers who fail to sell the district.
Yeah.
This feels to me like it was taken out of the Honda used car salesman's manual. And maybe that's what the salesperson does about the assistant manager in your local Honda dealership and tells that to the district office. But that's not what student teachers and cooperating teachers do. And that's not what school districts should be doing.
Now, when I think about that one, if we really took that seriously, who would ever be a mentor teacher and who would ever go into student teaching if you knew that that was the relationship, that at some point both of you are looking at each other as saying, I'm going to tell on you. Oh, yeah, well, I'm going to tell on you.
I'll be honest with you. If I knew that one of my student teachers was doing that, I would pull them out of the placement and we'd have an awfully serious discussion.
I I think I would do the same. All right, let's get on to the last one, number five. Now here we're back in the game. Make sure, school districts, that you communicate constantly with higher education partners.
Well, and again, here what Kate means by communication is by sharing data. And the thing, I mean, the quote here is that we need to do a much better job collecting data during the student-teacher application process and the student-teaching experience, and then sharing that data with partner higher education students or institutions. I think that my job is to have as little communication about data with cooperating teachers. They are inundated with data from school districts who are obsessed with metrics and measurement. And what I'm trying to do is not make taking a student-teacher more work for them. In fact, we've changed our evaluation forms. We don't have any numbers left on our evaluation forms. And what I use now is a version of the National Association for the Education of Young Children form that's used with infants and toddlers, and it's all narrative. It's all anecdotal. It's stories. You can attach pictures. It's about what kind of a teacher is this young person becoming? Where are things that we can help them learn and grow? Where are they already doing a wonderful job? And how can we help them as they move into the profession? And it's a way to start a conversation with the three of us, the troika between student teacher, mentor teacher, and university supervisor. The last thing I want to start a conversation on is data.
But you know, you just laid it out there so beautifully, too. Here's what Kate doesn't understand one bit is the whether it's 3-4 levels of relationship that occurs between a higher education program, the student teaching candidate, the mentor teacher, the school district, the building principal, the supervisor. There's such a complexity of relationships and how those things work and how we do these and how we work with each other that the idea that there's going to be some data approach to streamlining this into, you know, take this widget, put this widget in this piece, and it's going to work. Again, it's the whole idea of ed reform is based on this simple, silly numeric ranking system that we can always do this, and that the way humans react are somehow going to be quantifiable. And I just think of all the times we have Alfie on the show, and he rails against this, that we just, you know, it's like, you're trying to say that the process of learning to become a teacher, which is highly set around working with children, adults, community members, schools, and school districts, let's take away the human interaction part of that, and let's just not look at it, and let's count things, and that'll make it better.
Well, you know, I think you can tell a lot about someone's beliefs by the last sentence in their article. And here, Kate's last sentence tells us everything. Most important, first-year teachers would arrive in their classrooms fully knowing what to do and how to teach.
Yep.
And that tells me that Kate has never taught anyone anything and certainly has never supervised student teachers. What I tell my student teachers is when you get your first job, you do not fully know what to do. And when you leave your last job, you still don't fully know what to do.
It's a professional.
But learning how to teach is a lifetime journey. And what we're trying to do is get you to understand what you don't know, what you kind of know, and what you need to know more of, and then light the fire and make sure that you're excited about that journey.
Well, Mitchell, I got to say, again, thank you for busting pencils on that one, brother.
Happy to do it. Always good to talk with you.
You too, Mitchell. We will talk soon. Thank you very much.
He is the acclaimed author of the most awesome book that anybody in teacher education has ever read, To Teach. He is the conservatives' quote best friend, and he's actually my friend. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Dr. Bill Ayers.
Thank you, Tim. Nice to see you.
So you've been on the show before. It's been a while since we talked to you, but you know, I got really interested because I was looking on Facebook and I saw this book review posted by you on Facebook instead of, you know, the normal traditional outlet of our old Secretary of Education, Arnie Duncan's new book.
Right.
And, I mean, so the title, just, it's this massively long title, right?
Well, the title is short. It's How Schools Work.
How Schools Work.
And then the subtitle is An Inside Account of Failure and Success from One of the Nation's Longest Serving Secretaries of Education. That's the subtitle. But the title's quick and snappy, and it seems direct and obvious how schools work. That's what the book is supposed to be about.
So he's going to tell us from his almost 8 years of being the Secretary of Education.
I think you undercounted it. He was almost 8 years Secretary of Education, but he was 5 years the head of the Chicago schools. And so, 4 years. So that's 12 years total that he was leading schools. And that's an important accomplishment.
And so if anybody would know how schools work, it should be.
Well, you're saying that tongue-in-cheek.
I know I'm saying tongue-in-cheek, but... So what do we get from the book, though? I mean, is this a reflection? Is there deep analysis?
Well, I should say that I've known Arne Duncan for 20 years in Chicago. And, you know, when he was appointed Secretary of Education, many of us were disappointed because we were hoping, those of us who were educators, were hoping that Obama would pick an educator. Yeah. That is, that he would pick Linda Darling Hammond, for example, who was the head of the search committee searching for a Secretary of Education. But he passed over Linda in favor of Arne, and Arne had a couple of qualities that were, you know, very important to President Obama. He was much like the president himself. He was young, he was charismatic, he had a great outside jump shot, and he was a decent human being. The problem is he doesn't know schools, and the problem with this book is Arne Duncan hasn't learned a thing.
Right. I mean, the qualifications, right? I mean, let's just go over them. His qualifications, other than being appointed, were watching and feeling upset because of his mother directing like a child care center.
Well, we're going back now.
I know, but I mean, like, he's not a teacher.
No, he's not a teacher. He's not an
He's not an ed leadership. He's not a college professor.
That's correct. He comes out of the Chicago political milieu, but he was selected by Mayor Daley to be the superintendent of the Chicago schools, or what they now call the CEO of the Chicago schools. And so when President Obama picked him, he was picking him because of his 4 years of experience in an urban school district.
Leading a big urban school.
Yeah, and he had been a disaster in Chicago. But let me go to the book.
Yeah. Let's
so the title, How Schools Work. There's actually nothing in the book about how schools work. You would expect there would either be some analysis, some prescription of policy, or some examples of working schools, but it's none of that. What it really is focused on is this provocative opening sentence, which is, I'm quite certain, deliberately meant to get a rise out of readers and get an audience. But the opening sentence of the book is, education lies. That's a, you know, that the idea is
deceptive. Lies, right?
Well, it lies. It tells lies. That's right. And that is the theme of the book. The theme of the book comes from his experience working as a volunteer in his mother's after-school program, and the opening story becomes the touchstone. Although lies and lying becomes a metaphor for the whole book, but the opening story is about a kid that Arne Duncan was tutoring in the south side of Chicago, who thought he was doing very well. He was getting relatively good grades. He was a good athlete. He was planning to go to college. And Arne began tutoring him and realized that he really was almost functionally illiterate. And so his big gripe and his big campaign was, we have to stop social promotion. We have to stop the idea that kids can be pushed forward without mastering content, without gaining skills. I don't find that criticism particularly awful, although it's particularly...
There's no research.
Well, it's somewhat superficial is the real problem. Policy people come along and do a lot of things, or politicians come along. So it's a compelling argument to say, let's not have social promotion. But the next guy will come along and make another compelling argument, which is, we don't want 12-year-olds in the first grade. We have to do something. But neither of them get to the heart of the matter. And Arne Duncan's book misses the heart of the matter dramatically. And the heart of the matter is, can we see education as a human right, that every human being has a right to a decent education focused on the development of the full human personality, accessible within reach of their home? I mean, does every kid have that right?
So the local community public school.
Exactly. Article 26 of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights says every human being, every child, has a right to an education that develops their full personality and that should be accessible to them and free.
Free.
And public.
Right.
So it shouldn't be that you have to jump through hoops. Either you don't have to move to a different neighborhood or go to the suburbs or find a Catholic school or go to private school in order to get a decent education. It should be on order because you're born and because you're a child. That's what Arne Duncan does not embrace. Instead, he embraces the corporate, the model that's been forwarded for the last several decades of corporate school reform, which basically sees education as a product
right.
to be sold at the marketplace. And Arne embraces the whole trifecta. He's against the collective voice of teachers. He finds that unnecessary. He embraces the idea that that a test score can stand in for a decent education, that a single metric on a single high-stakes standardized test can stand in for a decent education, and he embraces the idea that we ought to let private entrepreneurs come into the public space and take it over. So there's nothing in his program that points to revitalizing the project of public education. It's very much an endorsement of what's already going on from both liberals and conservatives, Republicans and Democrats, the New York Times, MSNBC, and Fox News. So that's the tragedy of the book. He learned nothing. All he does is kind of regurgitate the corporate school reform agenda in a particularly uncompelling way,
well,
I must say.
It's not reflective of any type of learning, like you just said. I mean, it's reiterating in one sense.
Yeah.
It's like corporate reformers, you know, I've talked to other people, they won't go away, whether it's Bill Gates, whether it's Eli Broad, they're just going to come up and reinvent and say, it's some way, it's some place, if I spend enough money testing, measuring,
yeah,
we're going to fix it.
Yeah.
And I've made this argument with politicians saying, if one more politician puts one more dollar towards measuring poverty, because
yeah.
that's what we're doing,
right.
I can't support that as education
right.
reform, because that's
right.
not education reform.
Right.
That's keeping in place the gap that we measure.
Yeah, that's correct. And I think that's a central point. The other thing, though, about Arne Duncan not learning anything, this is written as a memoir. It's not particularly well written, but it's a memoir. The basic task of memoir is to show on the page a mind in argument with itself. In other words, what makes a good memoir work isn't kind of a defensive or a self-justifying tone, but is an intimate tone where you're trying to figure something out and you're doing it on the page. There's no reflection in this at all. The subtitle, An Inside Account of Failure and Success, the only failure Arne Duncan will cop to, and he cops to it over and over, is a failure to communicate.
Right.
Now, the failure to communicate is a cliche in our culture. And when anybody trots that out, what they're basically saying is, I'm right.
Right.
But
you didn't get it.
Yeah. So the great unwashed, the parents don't get it. The teachers and their self-serving and self-dealing teachers' unions don't get it. Politicians don't get it. And Arne's only self-criticism is, I failed to communicate. It brought to my mind the classic film Cool Hand Luke, where the prisoner who's rebelling against all the oppression he faces, every time he gets caught doing something against the rules, the captain, an authoritarian, autocratic, fascist character, says, what we have here is a failure to communicate. And of course, what that is prelude to doubling down on the oppression. So what we have in Arne's account, he failed to communicate that test scores are great. He failed to communicate that that everyone should be lined up in terms of winners and losers. He failed to communicate that race to the top was, you know, God's gift to the world. And on, but it's always a failure to communicate. And what he misses is that actually none of these things work well for any kids, but they particularly oppress the very kids he claims to want to help. The kids who are poor, the kids who have come from traditionally marginalized and silenced and erased groups, African-American kids, immigrant kids from poor countries, and so on. So what's galling about Duncan's book, and what really kind of set me off the cliff is that after 12 years of being a school leader, and a systems leader, he comes back to Chicago. He can't find a single public school for his own children. And so he sends them to an elite private school, which is the school he went to and the school that his wife teaches in. That's the University of Chicago Lab School. I have no problem with him sending his kids to the lab school. My problem is that he has advocated for the rest of us a regime that disempowers, that miseducates, and that guarantees failure in the largest sense. While for his own kids, he wants something better. He wants a full arts program. He wants small classes. He can live with a very well-respected and unionized teacher corps. All that is fine for his kids. But for our kids, he's saying, no, you all have to live under the testing regime. You have to live under the privatizing of the public space. And we do not want to hear the collective voice of teachers, because those of us who do the testing and who have the big data know better than you do.
Well, he is the one and only Dr. Bill Ayers. And what I would say is no need to go out and buy that book, because
no,
you just got everything you need to know.
Exactly. I read it so you don't have to.
Right. So, Bill, hey, thanks for busting pencils.
We are Busting Pencils!
Hey, this is Tim from Rise Against here on Busted Pencils Radio.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zinn.
There has always been, and there is now, a profound conflict of interest between the people and the government of the United States.
My thanks to Mitchell Robinson, Bill Ayers, and you for listening. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Keep busting pencils.
Log on to bustedpencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk. Busted Pencils Radio.